Genius, we help you discover your many layers. You peel, you cry, you wake up with fresh eyes. Question life, question humanity, question society, but most of all, question yourself.
So, this episode is kind of an interesting one. It's a reverse interview. So Jojo was on my podcast on the first episode, sharing about Interwoven Productions. And then I think it was a couple of weeks back, we were kind of like touching base a little again. And then you messaged and suggested to me, like, how about doing an episode to sort of reflect on your journey, what you've been through, and sort of to, you know, have yourself be interviewed. So this is kind of where we are at. Jojo, maybe you want to share a little.
Yes, I first of all, can I just say wow, and how much I've enjoyed the Onions Talk podcast series. You interviewed me for the very first one, and I'm sure that's long lost and forgotten, and very much the least, but I enjoyed doing it because you asked really insightful questions about change, this issue of change. And then what has been such a pleasure is to hear your growth and understanding through this succession of extraordinary guests that you've had. And I was also aware of this sort of growing wealth of understandings that sat, and whether there were themes that were coming out. And it just felt like a really good time to sort of roll back and reflect. And that's what I'd like to do. I'd like to give that opportunity to you, Fia, to get back inside it and have a little look. And hopefully it's timely to do that. I think a lot of people were hearing you interviewing, hearing some of your little insights, will think, tell me more about Fia. Tell me what's led to this, what is your journey, and what led to this series, the Onions Talk series.
So it's been quite a long journey. So back when I was in London, I was in London 2014 to 2018. I kind of started with fashion because I was really intrigued by wearable art and how if you could wear a piece of artwork and bring it out on the streets, you bring art outside of gallery spaces, essentially. And then art suddenly becomes a lot more accessible to people. And then I thought, you know, if I could just make social political works and wear it out, then I'm going to change the world because people will start talking and caring about these things. And then I realized very quickly after a year of fashion that that's not how fashion works. That's not how the world and the profit-making industry works. It's very much about your publicity, and it's very much about selling stuff. And that there was so much environmental destruction in industry as well that I realized, okay, that's not my thing. That's not where you make art. You know, that's where you make money. And then I switched to a performance design practice course at Central Saint Martins. And then, you know, that was really exciting because it was a performance course. So it wasn't just theater. It was really experimental, sort of cutting edge performance art, where we were, you know, exploring all sorts of things, immersive environments, interactive performance, sort of no words kind of theater plays, productions, like really abstract works that I was sort of doing with my friends. And I was never really comfortable in that performance space because I'm actually quite a shy person. I think a lot of people don't really realize that, but I'm not a performer myself. So then I was really interested in how I could weave wearable art in through sort of costumes. And then that was, you know, 3 years of really experimenting with making social political performances and, you know, different ways of sort of like interactions, immersive experiences, participatory art, sort of within, I guess, theater settings or exhibition settings. And then I was also making films, which were, you know, sort of short experimental films or films that were talking about post-capitalism and sort of several different topics. And then I got really frustrated because we are, you know, constantly just engaging with the same kind of audience, where either you have intellectuals or you have people who are in the arts industry. And I didn't feel like that was the sort of right audience for it. I felt like there needed to be an expansion. We needed to reach out to more people. We needed to reach out to the public, essentially, where you're not just attracting a certain group of people with a certain kind of background. So then I started to do public interventions. I made these robot pieces, and then I went out to public spaces, and I just started to use that as an attraction point for conversation starters. And then that opened up a lot of different conversations and topics that I was interested in back then. So like, what is home? That was a piece that went on for like a number of years, maybe 2 or 3 years, around different places in London. And then, you know, other conversations like around memories. So like happy and sad memories. I think that kind of also had a mental health angle, where I guess also in the arts industry, where, you know, I think mental health is something that a lot of artists struggle with, and sensing that and feeling through my own experiences as well, that we don't create enough spaces to open up these conversations and allow people to share what is bad, because, you know, you are just expected to be happy and look positive all the time. And I wanted to create a space for people to actually be able to share, you know, what hurts, where is the pain coming from, and to be able to support each other through that. And I was thinking, you know, how could I do it with participatory art? And then I did this piece called Toby Time, where it's like this pink tent that you get to enter, and then Toby, well, he's got like eyes and mouth and stuff, and then you enter, you can seal yourself in, and you have your own personal space to write a happy or sad memory. And then after you're done, you put your happy memory or sad memory into the bad memory eraser box or the happy memories box, and then in exchange you get to pick somebody else's happy memory and bring it away with you. So that was kind of the start of my, like, you know, participatory art journey and practice. When I first did that, it was at Field Day, London Field Day. It was the second largest music festival. And I thought, you know, that was, I would probably get really, you know, happy memories, because that's where, you know, people are there for the music, they are there for the atmosphere, they are there for the booze. But the saddest memories I got was from Field Day. And you have so many young adults or kids who are old enough to understand the issues, but not old enough to leave home. And so much was shared of, you know, family situations and environments where they cannot leave. And then I think the part of me where I'm like, okay, I just want to help them, I realized I wasn't in that capacity to do so, because I'm not a social worker and I'm not a therapist. I'm not licensed, and that's not my role as an artist. Then where does that line draw and end, you know? At the very start, because I didn't know, and I just wanted, you know, with all good intentions to support people, I wrote, if you wanted a reply, just write your email down. And then someone actually did. And I really struggled. I didn't know what to reply. And I didn't know what to respond in a way that is going to be supportive. But then, you know, The real question I had to ask myself was how far into this journey do you want to support this person? It's not even like, I'm not like a friend, I'm not a professional that's hired to support. And, you know, where does that line draw, you know? And then if someone starts to emotionally depend on me because there is a support there, then how far can I go with my limited resources and energy? And if at some point I have to cut it off, then what does this mean for that person? You know, am I going to end up doing more harm? And I think these are like really real questions that I never realized. And maybe some people think I'm thinking too much, but these are really valid questions, and ethics as well. So then I eventually drafted an email and I sent it out. But the email address, I think it was a fake one or whatever. It didn't send through. So then, you know, that opened up all of these questions that I had in my head, and I'm like, okay, I need to connect with other people in this field who have experience, because I can't do this alone. And if I want to develop this as my practice, I've got to really start seriously thinking about what this means. Back then, I did a film with a friend on post-capitalism, global sort of citizenship, and all of these sort of different topics. And the dean of my university back then, Mark, he saw the film, he emailed us, and he was like, you know, there's this program called European Academy of Participation. It's a European project, and they're looking for participants. So the project was to develop a master's in participatory art, and it brought together a lot of different networks in Europe that has that niche in participatory design or art. So then I was like, well, this is perfect for me. And then I applied for it, I got in, and these sort of sessions, it took place in several different countries. So the first one was in London, and you know, it was such a wealth of experience and people from different communities. Like, for example, in Portugal, you have MESH, which really brings together the entire sort of like country network of theater practitioners in Portugal who are working with communities through theater, form theater, and all these different methodologies, and all like in prison spaces and festivals. And it was just so exciting to get to meet them. And we were having these different conversations. There were like architects, urban planners, designers from, I think it was Bucharest. And there were just so many really interesting people from different perspectives, different disciplines kind of related to the arts who came together. And we had these workshops where we learned together, and we got to, you know, really discuss from a practice point of view what ethics means, you know, how do you achieve financial sustainability, independence in your work. And even though there were more questions than we had the answers, it was so nice and beautiful to have that community and network of support where people actually understood that. And I think I was also getting quite frustrated working on my dissertation, writing about art and social impact, and then realizing that, you know, so much of this literature I was reading, these people writing don't actually have physical, like practical experience hands-on working with communities. And they are just writing based on other case studies or literature from people who have done it. And I felt this disconnect between the academia and what's actually happening out there. And then I felt, okay, I don't feel like as much as university is great to get you to meet the right people, it doesn't feel like it's the right place to be if I want to actually learn what this practice is. So then after sort of that project went on for about 1 or 2 years, and then the first one in London, and then I went to Bucharest as well, and afterwards to Marseille in France. Along the way, I was connecting with a lot of people, keeping these contacts. I graduated in 2018. And then back in 2017, end of the year, I was like, we have to do something about this network. There's some, like, I have to bring people together and, you know, have a centralized sort of platform where people are actually connected so that we can continue these conversations. So I think that was really what pushed me to start INCEP. So INCEP started end of 2017, started as a Facebook group, which is still active right now. So INCEP is International Network for Socially Engaged Practitioners. And then from there, I've just been constantly reaching out to people. I think I came back to Singapore for a little bit, and then I was connecting with people who are working in socially engaged practice locally, and then also sort of still expanding in Europe. I also took part in this program called Future Studio in my university, which was conducted by Internet Age Media, IM. So they were featured in one of the sort of earlier episodes in a podcast. And that was like really mind-blowing because they are so much into tech, which actually I'm not so much a tech person. It's more the community side. But then the tech and sort of agency space has a very different understanding of what community is, I guess, from a marketing point of view, which I thought was quite interesting, thinking like just, you know, seeing the sort of methodologies that they use, which is a lot more structured than, I guess, the ways that we do it as socially engaged practitioners or artists. And then when I went to Barcelona to present with the rest of the team at Future Studio at IM in back in, I think that was 2018 in Barcelona. So Internet Age Media, they've got like IM Weekend, which is an annual event that brings together so many really interesting people in the tech industry. And these are people who are really curious about, you know, how can tech be for good? How can we use like our practice and resources to actually do good work? So then I thought, right, that's a huge potential to do something with them as well. And I think like all of these different questions from the tech space also really excited me. So then like INCEP became something that I guess moved away from just the art space into thinking about, you know, not just people who are, you know, artists or designers, but, you know, how about people who are in different fields but also want to do social good and change. So then that sort of became a more general socially engaged practitioner. So people who are engaged in social topics, engaged with communities. Before I graduated, I also went to Copenhagen Tech Festival and then realized from there that so many people in the tech industry were sharing that, right, they're comfortable and they're earning a lot of money, and in material sense, they are good, but then they want to do more. They want to actually contribute. I was like, right, there's a space in there that can really be bridged. So then I was still kind of figuring out how can I continue in SEP. And I guess because of EAP, what I was familiar with was the sort of European project model, the connections within EAP, one connected me with another and another. And then I got in touch with Samir based in Marseille. And then he was like, okay, this is a contact that we've worked with before. They do international exchange between Europe and Asia. Your network could work with them, or you might be able to find some ways to work together. So then before I left Marseille, during the project of European Academy of Participation, I met up with the director. He was like, oh wow, great, probably we can work together, why don't you just come to France after you graduate, and then we will see how things go from there. So then I did this crazy thing of, practicalities and all of that aside, I just followed my heart and I was like, I'm gonna make INSEP work. And then after graduation, I think I worked at my university for a little bit, and then I had to leave because of my visa, and then I just went to France with my suitcase without any sort of plans. In France, I connected with the organization and they were like, oh, actually there is this 1-year visa that you could apply for and we could help you with, and then you can work in our organization for a year. So then I applied for that. One of my contacts was like, if you want to do European projects, you have to understand how it works. And that was really a year for me to understand that. I started out thinking that my research would be, pardon my neighbor's dog. And then I thought like one of the research would be financial independence and sustainability, which was like a big problem that resonated throughout all of these conversations at EAP and the sort of network. People really reflecting with the work that we're doing with communities and engagement, how can we actually sustain ourselves and earn a living through that when a lot of times it's not well paid or it's just not even paid. When I went to Marseille, France, my sort of agenda was that, okay, I'm going to figure out how artists could partner with NGOs that are skilled at writing funding applications to perhaps work together and find a model that would work to achieve this sort of financial sustainability or independence. And then I spent a year working in Marseille. Before I started work, I was already there for about 3 months. And actually it was really exciting because I was in France, everyone only spoke French pretty much because it was Marseille. And then I had studied French for like 2 years or something back when I was 13 years old, but I could barely, understand or utter anything. So then it was really like reaching through old memories filled with like cobwebs and stuff to try and find out, okay, where is my vocabulary, French vocabulary, and where are the words? And then I still went and, participated in all these like professional conversations, networking events or conferences, and half the time I didn't understand what they were saying. And it was really interesting because I'm an Asian, I'm a young woman, I don't even speak good French, and people a lot of times just looked at me weird because what are you doing here? But I learned a lot along that process. And then I got myself involved in this thing called Citizen Campus, which was really exciting. There was like a branch from the government. Someone was really passionate about how, to engage with citizens on topics and creating the Citizen Campus to engage with different people and having really like this sort of bottom-up impact and skill. He got permission to be able to start something like that. But I guess on a larger whole, France was, going through at that time, Gilets Jaunes, the Yellow Vest movement, and a lot of that political sort of tension with the population and that. So I think what he was trying to do was, he was a part of the government, but it wasn't the entire of the agenda of the government. I don't know if this makes sense. So like he managed to push through with a project like this, but it's not like he's representative of the government because he just, I guess, was lucky with the right people and the right time to get the resources to do that. but it doesn't necessarily mean that the party or the entire the government would necessarily want to adopt a project like that as their way of engaging with citizens. I don't know if that is clear anyway. So then I was involved with a lot of conversations in that, and that I think also expanded me to understand the sort of French way of doing things and really interesting, like sort of the activist communities, the NGOs, the nonprofit sector, how everyone came together in ways that was quite strong as a social glue to support and to achieve, I guess, participatory democracy, whatever that means to them. So that sort of that year made me learn, like taught me a lot of things on many different levels, from this sort of participatory democracy, what communities mean in a place like Marseille, where it's second largest city, but it's also like a little village where, you know, you can just talk to a random stranger on the streets for 30 minutes like that. And also racism, how that felt, what that meant, how much more I have to fight for my, what I'm saying to be heard in a place where I am a minority. And also, I guess, this when you speak of your experiences that is negative and sheds a community or a country in a negative light, there's always that sort of resistance and defensiveness. And having to, you know, find the courage to still speak up, because if I don't, then that is never going to be seen as a problem that needs to be addressed. But then also having to bear the weight of, in some instances, hostility, but then it's also more often than not that sense of defensiveness and invalidating of my experiences. So I guess in that sense, that year taught me a lot, not just in France, but also doing European projects and always, you know, negotiating myself, not being a European, but then being in very European situations and contexts doing these projects. And it's not just about confidence or what you speak that is of value. Sometimes just because of the way that you look, the color of your skin or the lack of cultural references that would bridge in our understanding, then your words reach people in a way that is more difficult to be reached than if someone of their color or country would have conveyed it. You know, sometimes it's, even if we said the same things, it would not be received with the same weight. So understanding that was really exhausting, actually. I think like that year, I there was a period where I was so exhausted. You know, when you have to deal with harassment on the streets pretty much on a daily basis and being so angry all the time, and then going to the organization and trying to have these conversations but not quite being heard or understood, and then sensing that there isn't really a space for such conversations anyway because nobody wants to talk about colonization there. So then I was really reflecting, you know, do I want to stay in Europe? And I think I was also at a point of burnout. Back then, I was doing a couple of projects. One, I was working with a homeless man. And I guess realizing that, you know, how a welfare state that supposedly should take care of everyone failed to do so. He served in the military as a légionnaire. And then he ended up being homeless because, well, he was injured. And he couldn't continue his military service. So he went back to France, got retrained as a firefighter. He had a heart attack. He couldn't continue that work. And he was applying for jobs, but because of health conditions, he couldn't get into anything. And then his sort of like support ran out. He was applying for emergency funding. The agency just kept saying that they didn't receive his application. And then he was bam, out on the streets and then homeless because, you know, he was 60 back then. His pension would only be released when he's 62 because that's because he didn't finish his military service, which, you know, was because of an injury. And then he's just out on the streets homeless. And the sort of violence that's on the street, it's, I guess, unimaginable. Someone tried to burn him alive, you know, in the middle of the night. And then because he was in the military, he instinctively just drew out his dagger and then it went through that person's hand, and that person ran off with the dagger in his hand. But, you know, it's like these sort of crazy situations that would happen, and mafias, and, you know, like that sort of violence when you're homeless and you already don't have much, but people still want to steal stuff from you, and him not even being able to have a phone because his stuff gets stolen so often. And then realizing that, and I think it was a real shock, because I think coming from Asia and with our history of colonization, you paint a very good picture of Europe, that, you know, they are rich, they're welfare state, they take care of people. And then when I was there, you know, at the heat of Gilets Jaunes, seeing the sort of police brutality and violence, whether there were children or pregnant women in the crowd, they still gassed everyone. Like, you know, the tear gas was just released everywhere. They didn't care. And some were just specifically targeting civilians and chasing after them and just being as violent as they could. And, you know, having blood everywhere and ambulance waiting behind because they knew what was going to happen. That was like, that was really shocking. And I guess I also saw a lot of contradictions in there where, you know, France supposedly is proud of freedom of expression and proud of, you know, that sort of pride from the French Revolution, that the citizens can actually achieve something and do something and have their voices heard. But the reality was not that. And the sort of picture that is painted from an ex-colonial strong country sort of point of view, and what I processed as a young kid, the sort of images that is flashed in media and the sort of perspective or opinion of the West is not what reality really is. So then that was really interesting. And then I was working with minors who were seeking asylum, with Médecins Sans Frontières, which is Doctors Without Borders, and just also seeing how precarious the situations are when, if you're lucky, you get picked up on the street by an organization. And if they have space, then they can take you in. Otherwise, you are still homeless on the streets. And people would still try and rob you anyway, even after what you've been through, having crossed the Mediterranean Sea or having seen so many people die along the way, cross mountains. They arrive in Europe with a lot of hope, because that is the promise that, and the picture that, you know, ex-colonial places sort of pain. But when you arrive, that is not reality. People don't want you there, people don't welcome you, and this sort of hostility, as much as there is also the good side of, you know, non-profit organizations really trying to help as much as they can, but seeing that, sensing that, and doing, you know, doing food collection, also realizing that some bakeries or supermarkets are willing to give to homeless French people, but not necessarily to refugee groups, then you realize there is so much. There's so many layers of so many different things that's at play in a society that I didn't realize before. If I had not put myself in these situations where I'm exposed to that reality. And it was also a huge check on my privilege. The ways in which we question what home is, what belonging is, it's completely different. And also feeling like, as much as I gave a lot of my time to them, I never felt like it was enough. And eventually I had to leave because my visa was expiring. And I think I also needed some space to process all of that, to reflect, and some time for myself, because I felt like I was just sort of losing myself in all of that in which I was absorbing. I was working at the office Monday to Fridays, and then weekends I was volunteering with the kids and staying till like midnight or something, even like, you know, on weekdays after work. So my weekdays and weekends are all filled, and I was fulfilling, but I didn't really have space for myself. And I also kind of felt like after about 1 year plus working on in the sort of social sector in within organizations, I felt I needed to explore my art more and also go back to my art as an artist and develop that practice as well. And I felt there was like a split in identity. It's just very strange because like London me is a specific fear, France me is another fear, and France me, my friends in France, a lot of them don't know my artist side. And I felt like I was never sort of fully understood except for a few close friends. And that was just really, really strange. And I felt like I needed some time to process the sort of identity split. So the plan was that I really wanted to visit North America. There were a lot of social change agencies there that I've come across when I was doing my research online. And I wanted to understand how they managed to make things work. And I think upon reflection on the sort of social sector in Europe, it's so much funded by European funding. And it is not financially independent. In fact, it is very dependent on one stream of funding. And I just didn't feel like that was sustainable. And when looking at funding, also realizing that when you're receiving funding, what you're selling is actually impact reports. And so much work goes into logistics to service a system rather than actually working on the ground with people. And I felt like something is broken in the system that's not really working for social change. So I wanted to find alternative ways in which work can be supported. So then social innovation became like a natural sort of journey to explore. And then I went to New York first, and then went over to Canada. And I guess a part of me was also trying to tick off my bucket list, I guess, because I really want to visit these places. And when I was in France, it was really a lot of conversations with activists on apocalypse and how the world is going to end, the point of no return, we are there. And that people were looking at options, starting eco-villages or, you know, just completely foregoing this old system and capitalism and way of working. And just because I don't have the right visa to actually be able to do so, that wasn't an option that I could go and join. And also I needed a break from France. So then I was like, okay, Canada's got land, right? Maybe I can find something there. So that was like the sort of vague, but let's just explore sort of mindset. And then I went. And then when I was in Montreal, COVID hit that area of the world. And suddenly it was just a lot of movement and the frenzy of, you know, moving here and there and trying to find somewhere that would take me in. And there was a lot of, I guess, confusion and also uncertainty. And I was in a position where I didn't want to be on my own in a situation like this. So there was an opportunity for me to join somewhere, not really countryside, but I guess suburbs, small town with other travelers. So then I took that option up. And then since then, I was sort of like on different organic farms, which was really interesting because I've always wanted to learn about regenerative, restorative agriculture and permaculture. So then that gave me the sort of hands-on experience. So then that's also where I met Josh, who was featured as in the regenerative and restorative agriculture podcast episode. And it was just really interesting to see and hear the sort of Canadian perspective and also that sort of connection with the land. Like, I think growing up in a city like Singapore, where a lot of things are man-made, including nature, you don't have that depth of connection and that love because you don't grow up with it. Yet when I was on an artist residency with Katya in Finland, or being on like farms, just, you know, fields and forests around, learning about agriculture, they gave me a sort of different perspective of land and healing, ecological healing, and also permaculture principles. It's so much about imbalance with nature and finding harmony also within yourself that is really like a philosophy that could be adopted not just within agriculture, but in our own lives and work. So that was really interesting. And I was having a lot of really interesting conversations. And because everything went online because of COVID, I found myself being able to connect to a lot of change groups in North America. And I think because they have more people, they have more support and funding to have close these kind of conversations. There's more awareness as well. People were really conscious about many different issues, and I could find the space to be able to join those. So that was really cool. And then at some point I was like, okay, all these really interesting conversations and learning, I need to be able to document it somewhere, somehow. And then I just thought back at INSEP and the sort of the community, there's so much wisdom in there. There's so much amazing, so many amazing work that they're doing that I would really want to share it with the world. So then Onions Talk kind of came about while I was, you know, volunteering and working on farms and doing some like really menial repetitive tasks. And I was listening to podcasts. And then I thought, oh, I could just do it through a podcast, which allows me a way of bringing together the community that isn't like a time intensive method of bringing people together. So then I started that when I was in Canada, and started to just slowly reach out to people in the community that I've been in touch with, worked with, and have been having conversations with over the years. So Onions Talk started. It took some time to really build it up. And then at that time, also my tourist visa in Canada was expiring. And I had to rethink a lot of things. But then that process already opened up a lot of doors in the social innovation spaces, also because I just sent out emails and connected with people, you know, like being really thick-skinned, just to sort of reach out to the right people. Some I had responses, some not, but then it also opened up really interesting contacts and conversations. So I came back to Singapore, had really comfortable 2 weeks in a hotel doing my self-isolation quarantine and really thinking things through and preparing myself for this reality that I have not been in the past 6 years. So yeah, it's been quite a journey, but I guess that sort of answers how INSEP and Onions Talk sort of came about.
It does, and it's such a pleasure to, and I knew some of that journey, so we've been sort of connecting at various points over it, but such a pleasure to hear it in you know, explained in the way that each of those parts connect. And I've got so many questions, some that I have prepared, some that have come out of that explanation. But first of all, I'd just like to just stop and take a deep breath and reflect on just wow, Fia, the depth and breadth of your curiosity and your openness and your questioning and how you've allowed that your life to be led by that. I mean, most people don't. Most people wander. But they don't change their lives in any way in order to embrace that questioning. So just take a little moment to think, wow, that is extraordinary and unusual. And it makes you, you know, someone to have a little hug of, because I don't think I know anyone else who's allowed their life to be led by their questions and their open-hearted curiosity in quite the same way. So thank you for letting us share a little bit of that journey with you.
Hey, so the episode is actually a pretty long one, and I imagine your attention is probably pretty spent by now, so I'm going to do everyone a little favor to split this episode into two so that you can get your chocolate or your booze or whatever it is, your comfort food, re-energizer, and don't miss out on part two, because it's gonna cover some pretty interesting points, including key lessons from memorable episodes, post-capitalism and funding, who prescribes change, who dictates what change can happen, who has the power. If you're a funder, you probably should tune in. And finally, rethinking impact evaluation, what serves us and what doesn't, what's changed since you started the podcast. So don't miss out, catch you next episode.